Following are comments on William Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, Act 5. There's not the smallest orb which thou behold'st, but in his motion like an angel sings. Jessica and Lorenzo engage in a bit of romantic banter, and Lorenzo emphasizes the power of music to move and transform the listener. In Act 5, Scene 1, Lorenzo and Jessica discuss faith and faithlessness by referencing disappointed lovers such as Troilus, Thisbe, and Dido. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 1 through 24 inclusive. Perhaps by these means they are transitioning into mature married life after their wild initial romance, one involving the betrayal of a father and a heady escape from Venice proper. After Stefano announces that Portia will soon arrive home to Belmont, and Lancelot announces that Bassanio is on the way too, Lorenzo discusses with Jessica the power of music to transform the soul. In so doing, he touches upon the possibility of transformation and redemption. Lorenzo says that music, even earthly music as opposed to the heavenly harmonies lost to us because of our sin-induced mortality, will soften Jessica if she will only listen intently enough and open herself to the experience. Quote unquote, "There's not the smallest orb which thou behold'st, but in his motion like an angel sings." Ellipses. Such harmony is in immortal souls, but whilst this muddy vesture of decay doth grossly close it in, we cannot hear it. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 54 through 55. And lines 63 through 65. The whole stargazing scene is in comic contrast to what the play casts as Shylock's hard-heartedness, his inability to change, as Lorenzo may be insinuating when he says, quote unquote, "The man that hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 83 through 85. "If you had known the virtue of the ring, or half her worthiness that gave the ring." Portia lectures Bassanio over his failure to keep faith with her regarding his wedding ring, and Nerissa scolds Graziano for the same failure, but the spat is resolved in the comic spirit as the women show their husbands mercy. Still in Act 5, Scene 1, Portia appreciates the fine music, but at line 109 she makes it stop because she has another vehicle of transformation to tend to, the playfully stern lecture she's about to deliver. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 99 through 100. "The absoluteness of Antonio and Bassanio's oath-taking must be tempered. Mercy doesn't like extremes. To swear excessively is to take one's responsibilities lightly, replacing material reality with airily proffered words." Bassanio, in particular, has shown a willingness to break an oath to his intended wife to satisfy a male-centered demand, that of giving a gift to the supposed man who helped Antonio win his case. He and Graziano trivialize the marriage bond when, after making such a show of their fidelity, they break their excessive oaths at will. So Bassanio must be schooled by Portia about his responsibilities towards her as a faithful husband. She asserts that this marriage bond entails reciprocity and generosity, an accommodation that he has not yet fully acknowledged. Quote unquote, "If you had known the virtue of the ring, or half her worthiness that gave the ring." Act 5, Scene 1, lines 199 through 208. Portia may be obedient to her father, but she is not a fool, a slave, or a child. Her actions show her to be far more mature than the men in The Merchant of Venice. The point of the ring episode is that Portia will exercise mercy with respect to the decree she had previously issued. She didn't require the decree of faithfulness in the deadly fashion understood by Bassanio. She interprets her own words liberally rather than literally, and here in Act 5 she is generous enough to forgive Bassanio, since at least he put up a struggle, however brief, over the loss of the ring. That doesn't amount to full merit of pardon, but under Portia's dispensation, perfection isn't necessary. Antonio finds out that he isn't a pauper after all. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 275 through 279. We also hear that Shylock, upon his death, will, as ordered, quote-unquote, gift the remaining half of his estate to Lorenzo and Jessica. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 290 through 292. Bassanio, with Antonio's help, gets the chance to make a second affirmation of his constancy towards Portia, saying, quote-unquote, pardon this fault, and by my soul I swear I never more will break an oath with thee. Act 5, Scene 1, lines 247 through 248. It's probably worth noting that the oath is just as extreme as the previous ones he and Antonio have made. Even so, a generous understanding of speech and act is the essential contrast that the play posits between Christians and Jews. The former are represented as having the flexibility to transform and to be transformed, while Shylock remains implacable and experiences his enforced change as nothing short of torture. He remains outside the circle of happiness that concludes the play. As already noted, this latter inference is represented explicitly and sympathetically in Michael Radford's excellent 2004 production of The Merchant of Venice. Reflections on the conclusion of The Merchant of Venice. How should we understand the play's conclusion? Aside from all the happiness, Antonio, somewhat like Shylock, remains outside the charmed comic circle of shiny happy people holding hands, quote-unquote, to borrow a title from the band R.E.M. So his melancholy self-understanding seems to be validated by the play's ending. Antonio's part in life is a sad one, just as he had said in Act 1, Scene 1. That may be because Shakespeare recognizes the ambivalence of Elizabethan and more ancient attitudes towards the classical homosocial conception of male friendship that obtains between Antonio and Bassanio. The men's excessive rhetoric notwithstanding, the play's comic emphasis and structure positively demand that Antonio step aside so that Bassanio's orthodox pursuit of happiness with Portia may succeed. Jessica's story, however, seems to hold out the possibility of redemption for all. She's a Jewish woman whose free conversion for the sake of love stands in comic defiance against the spiteful Christian saying, quote-unquote, till the Jews be converted, as a way of saying never. We can reasonably contrast The Merchant of Venice with the religious skeptic Christopher Marlowe's 1589-90 masterpiece, The Jew of Malta, with its villainous merchant Barabbas, who dies horribly and deservedly at the play's end. But we will never really know what Shakespeare's own audience members thought about the conclusion, or indeed what the playwright himself thought of it. Is Shylock seen as getting what he deserves, or is he, to borrow Lear's anguished phrase in Act 3, Scene 2 of King Lear, a man, quote-unquote, more sinned against than sinning? Which counts for more, the pathos of Shylock's suffering and his earlier appeal in Act 3, Scene 1 to universal humanity, or the undeniable malice and cruelty he shows in his sustained attempt to take down a longtime Christian enemy? Is Portia's emphasis on the need to imitate God's mercy worthy to stand on its own, or is it largely or entirely undercut by the play's context, which underscores the Christian character's cliquishness and general failure to practice what they preach when it comes to outsiders? Perhaps what we can say with some confidence is that Shakespeare has provided enough strands and counter-strands in The Merchant of Venice to make the weaving of many interpretations at least plausible. This play is essentially comic, but for modern audiences, it seems, it is bound to remain an unsettling kind of comedy. Many directors, Michael Radford included, have chosen to present it as closer to a tragicomic or mixed affair instead of as a cheerful comedy. No doubt, many of Shakespeare's contemporaries saw little need to worry about the fate of Shylock, or Antonio for that matter. But we are not bound to cast aside those elements of the story in favor of rendering this difficult, disturbing play satisfying. We may do well to keep in mind Homer's request of his muse in the Odyssey. As Robert Fagles translates the request, Homer asks the muse to, quote-unquote, sing for our time, too. Each generation responds to a play or to any work of art in a way that makes sense to them. Is it too easy to suggest that in The Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare is advancing to his audiences their strong prejudices about Jews, only to challenge those same prejudices? Today's audiences must work this out for themselves. There is a range of opinion going from the conviction that the play is profoundly anti-Semitic to the claim that it opposes anti-Semitism. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Monday, August 18th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.